Welcome, everyone. This is January 29, 2011. This is the LaRouche Show, our weekly program from 3 to 4 Eastern Savings Time in the United States. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic today is Will You Eat Next Year? Special reports from Australia and Canada. And that defines our guest today. I am very glad to be welcoming them. I'll do right now from Melbourne and Montreal. First from Melbourne, down under, we welcome Nolene Isherwood. Welcome, Nolene.
Yes, hello, Marcia. Hello, everybody.
And Nolene is, among many things, she is a co-founder of the Citizens Electoral Council of Australia, which goes back, Nolene, what, at least 20 years?
23 years now, Marcia. 1988 we began.
And she has been a collaborator, she and her husband and family and many friends and colleagues throughout Australia, of Lyndon LaRouche over all of that time. She'll have a lot to say about the current situation. And she's on the executive board of the Citizens Electoral Council. So we'll get to her in just a few minutes. But I want to first welcome from Montreal, Jean-Philippe Lebleu. Welcome.
Hello, sir.
And Jean-Philippe has been on here in the last few years several times, I'm glad to say. And he's a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement Canada, of the Committee for the Republic of Canada. And Jean-Philippe, I know, will have a lot to say in a moment. What I'd like to do, when we mentioned the word will you, when we said will you eat next year, we're not kidding. What we've got is a world food crisis. But before we get to the topic of food specifically, let me say a few things about context and some of the latest political developments. So then you can hear more from Nolene and Jean-Philippe. The situation we have, of course, let's just turn to the headlines you see from people on the streets in Egypt. We have a general wave of tumult internationally because the breakdown in the physical economy is proceeding at such a pace and such an extent, connected to the financial blowout of this decades-long monetarist system of speculation and so forth. It's best described as an imperial system, British Empire system. We have such a process underway that is the context in which specifically you can't count on anything. You can't count on having enough food. For many years, there hasn't been enough produced internationally, and you see that in specific areas, Africa, some parts of the Caribbean, Southeast Asia. But back to the general crisis, we have one way to summarize it is the very existence of nation states is now at stake. That's what you see in Egypt or Tunisia, Yemen, elsewhere, that what people, especially youth, but anyone need for the opportunity to be productive, to physically have conditions to live in, to politically have the existence of nation states, this is what's been undermined. Now, in Europe, you see it, you can visualize your own headlines, but there are those in Ireland, especially Gerry Adams, the Sinn Féin, has been standing up to the dictatorship of the IMF and this system that's cracking up anyway in the Eurozone and internationally. And you could go around the world and look, as I say, at the headlines, that what's happened is, after decades of let's call it the British Empire kind of tentacles working through the banking network, the Inter-Alpha network, as it called itself since 1971, working through figures, working through subversion in the United Nations, through environmentalist hoax. What's been imposed is the prevention of necessary physical infrastructure, the so-called free trade, which has been rigged trade on behalf of these looting rights of these imperial interests, huge bubbles of speculation, successive waves of them, till the breakdown point. The bubbles themselves, you could almost say, pop themselves, like the U.S., the so-called U.S. home mortgage securitization bubble. Prior to that, there were others, but So we're in this situation of the blowout proceeding. Now, Lyndon LaRouche summarized that last week on Saturday when he gave an international webcast through the LaRouche Political Action Committee. That's January 22nd. And in advance of that, he issued, and we've been circulating, his prepared remarks, and then there's his discussion. I certainly hope everyone listening to this program today, this discussion, is familiar with that and thinking about that, because that he did give a state of the world, in fact, in terms of a state of the union of what's happening in the United States. And you know, days later, just 2 or 3 days ago, a report came out in the United States from a group which was a commission on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, it was called, formed 2 years ago, and run by a man named Mr. Angelides from California, who was a longtime financial officer of the state of California. And this 600-page report described the last 30 years of successive bubbles and deregulation of banking and the kind of thing I just alluded to, including the fact that in 1999, the FDR-era banking regulation law called the Glass-Steagall Act from 1933 was repealed, which was a contributing, a major factor. It had been ignored, but anyway, in the 90s and 80s. But this Angelides report came out, and it's something that if you've known what Mr. LaRouche has been warning of for the last 20 years, it just is a description of that process. But the issue is, what are we going to do about this? Naturally, part of the problem, not the solution, you saw in the State of the Union given by President Obama on Tuesday this past week, who is, after all, was put in there as a flunky for London. And what we need to address is he needs to be moved out of the way so we can restore the Glass-Steagall Act in the United States, the principle internationally, to end this breakdown process and this allowing this kind of speculation to go on. Now, in fact, what I want to stress to people before we turn it over, and Nolene is going to start with a situation report in Australia, but we're now in hand-to-hand ideas combat in about 40 states around the United States on what needs to be done on an emergency basis, LaRouche's program. And we have the LaRouche Political Action Committee teams, as I say, from Harrisburg to Albany to Sacramento, you name it, Austin, Texas. And I encourage everyone listening now, either whether this is archived or you're with us live today, to engage in this. Activate, certainly give resources, financial, give time, and because we need this kind of timing of the intervention, that is to do get things done now, in fact yesterday, that we have the mean, we have the mechanism that the president can be removed constitutionally under Article 25, Section 4. We have the what policy we should have. I've been mentioning the Glass-Steagall Act itself to restore, and the principle, and absolutely we have the way to start rebuilding. And in North America, the North American Water and Power Alliance, we need to go for this now. Now, with that general sweep of background, let me just say something by way of introduction to our guests from Canada and Australia when it comes to, are we going to eat or not? It's simple. The physical degradation has reached the stage where worldwide we're producing less food than we're eating. Now, what I mean is we're eating up any reserves that are around. There's tremendous bidding to get to line up shipments of grain from the Chicago Exchange, from exchanges that serve Asia. I'm not being metaphorical here. I wanted to say a couple of specific things to point this up, because if you take grain, wheat, rice, corn, and other kinds of grain, rye and oats and so forth, is one marker for for eating in the world. It's true you can live on potatoes. The British forced Ireland to do that, remember, and we had the 1840s potato famine. But when it comes, most more places in the world and more people depend on wheat, for example, than rice in quantitative terms. We need more rice, we need more wheat, we need more corn. But of the wheat that's been produced in recent years, if you add it up in Russia and China, as well as Australia, United States, Argentina, and so anywhere, about 650 million tons might be produced. And some places under the British imperial system for the last 40, 50 years were kind of turned into the world's pantry, including Australia and Canada, as well as the wheat belt of the United States. And so that out of 600 some million tons produced internationally every year of wheat, whereas in India it's produced and consumed, in China it's produced and consumed, the surplus that goes into trade, maybe 140 million, 50 million tons of wheat, a great deal of that, 30 some million tons came from the US, and together 30 some million tons came from Australia and Argentina, excuse me, and Canada. Also some from Argentina, but you can't count on it because, and Olin will describe what's happened in Australia. It's a crazy thing to have been setting up kind of export zones anyway from the point of view of the benefit of nations, but this was done for commodity cartels like Cargill, Bunge, Louis Dreyfus, that operated with the Imperium. And so what we have now in plain physical volume is the wheat isn't there, whereas 3 years ago, maybe 140 or 50 million metric tons were exported internationally. Then it went down to 130 million tons. This year it might be 120 million tons because Russia, that exported over 10, 14 million tons in recent years, is going to be exporting nothing. So we didn't come, I'm not trying to list tables of numbers and figures here, but this is the situation we face where these Australia and Canada, whose citizen leaders you're going to be hearing from, are part of the Commonwealth. They are actually the LaRouche collaborators. They are leading the charge to end this system. And let me just throw one thing out here for a lot of our listeners and participants in this program are based in the United States. Although you know LaRouchePub.com, where you hear this, has this program archived. But you know, the entire Australia population is far less than simply the population of California, although Australia is as big or bigger than the 48 states. Canada is bigger than the 48 states. And likewise, I think the population is a million less, fewer than in the state of California. This is crazy. So that, with that introduction as to kind of the crazy condition of our planet, Nolene, why don't you begin with your with what you how you want to lead off the discussion?
Thanks, Marcia. Well, just listening to you speak, and I'm reflecting on the absolutely extraordinary circumstances that Australia has faced, even just in the last several weeks, regarding our food security situation, even for our own nation, let alone the the rather hefty responsibility that we do have as a country for providing food for much of the rest of the world. And it really is frightening because I think most people would have heard something about the flooding that we've had in the state of Queensland, which is obviously it's one of our biggest food producing regions. It's the subtropical part of the country. And the floods that we've experienced there for the past month have been some of the biggest floods since European settlement. of Australia. What some of our international listeners may not know is that the floods have not been confined to the state of Queensland. They've affected a large part of the northern part of New South Wales. They've affected virtually a third of the western part of Victoria, which is my state, down in the south. They've affected the northern part of Tasmania, and very soon will affect probably a third of the state of South Australia. And I say very soon because the enormous volumes of flood water that have fallen both in Queensland and in Victoria all drain down through what we call our Murray-Darling Basin and exit into the Southern Ocean through South Australia. So just to give you some sense of the of what we're talking about, in Queensland, which has been the most they've had by far the most publicity because of the extraordinary situation there. The floods have covered more than 1 million square kilometres in Queensland alone. So that's something like 386,000 square miles, or the equivalent area of France and Germany combined. That's just in one state. And the amount of water that has, some of that water obviously goes, travels west and down through the continent. Much of it floods immediately out to sea on the along the coastal strip. In the central Queensland river, there's a big river there called the Dawson. And this will just give you some sense of one river alone, the volume that has flooded through there. They measure the volumes in Sydney harbours. And Sydney harbour is about 500 gigalitres, or for our Americans, 400,000 acre feet. And at one stage, the Dawson had one Sydney harbour of water flowing through the city of Rockhampton every hour.
Oh, my.
And this went on for days and days. So that's it. There's enormous volumes of water that have just simply flooded out to sea. Equally, probably those volumes or more that have travelled downstream and inland. In Victoria, there were enormous rains, unprecedented, the biggest floods in Victoria for 200 years. And much of that water is still on the move, and it's now formed a giant inland sea, which is something like, we're in kilometres here, but 40 kilometres wide by about 90 kilometres long. And this is an inland body of water that is just slowly making its way down the Murray River. Once the northern floodwaters and the southern waters meet in South Australia, we're expecting probably the biggest floods in that state, probably in the history of the country as well. It'll take a month, perhaps 2 months, for most of that water to reach South Australia. So it gives you some idea about what we're dealing with here. And the losses are, the politicians tend to measure them in monetary value, of course, which is one way of looking at it, but it doesn't really give you a complete picture. But even so, the combined flood losses across the whole nation, which have affected nearly all of our food bowls in each state, somewhere between $13 and $15 billion worth of loss to agriculture and industry. But that really doesn't take into account the devastation to local roads, rail, bridges, all of the necessary infrastructure to even get the produce from the farms and properties to market. So our estimate is that we're looking at, without doubt, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of damage and immediate infrastructure repairs that are going to have to be made. So it's, I mean, even in Victoria alone, pardon me, the floods there have affected somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 separate farms, and there's been flooding in more than 72 towns across Western Victoria. I won't go through all the losses, but you can imagine what we're looking at and the devastation that that's meant for our food security, both for ourselves and for what we would normally be exporting around the world. So that's just what we're facing in terms of the flood crisis. Unfortunately, if that were all we were dealing with, it would be a relatively straightforward proposition if we could convince the government to drop all the green ideology and begin the rebuilding. However, we've got another rather critical battle on our hands, which I think is even more profound, and that is the battle that we're up against with the which is really run directly by the British Empire as a genocide operation to depopulate Australia. Now that might sound strange to other places, because we only have 23 million people in Australia as it stands. But thanks to the green ideology and the proponents of this depopulation agenda, they are wanting to reduce our population back down to as low as 6 to 7 million. And the way they're doing it is targeting our largest food growing region in the country, the Murray-Darling Basin. And again, you know, just to give people some sense of what we're talking about with the Murray-Darling, this is one of the great miracles of agriculture in the world, really. It's about, I think it's the fifth largest river drainage basin in the world, but it's also one of the driest. And it has been miraculously transformed through human intervention, through the use of irrigation. And this is, you know, you're talking about an area of 1 million square kilometres, 14% of the entire continent of Australia. And the great majority of our food, both for domestic use and export, comes from the Murray-Darling Basin. So just there alone, somewhere between 60 and 80 million people worldwide are fed from the Murray-Darling. So to target that basin for destruction, and I can say some more about how that's being done, but there's no question that this is an absolute policy of genocide, and not just for Australia, but for the human population. And that's the reason, Marsha, my husband Craig Isherwood, who's the leader of the Citizens Electoral Council, has just recently issued an emergency address to the nation in which he launched a war of national liberation against the British Empire. So I can say some more about that, but But
Right.
it's a really, it is a truly extraordinary situation.
Yeah, let me just throw in here, the people listening or people can know from our website, larouchepub.com, where you see this, where you access this radio program, is that you go on international links and you can go on to the Citizen Australia and get the relevant website will come right up, and you can see the Craig Isherwood speech announcing this war of national liberation from the British Empire. And you can also see, I think, Nolene, it was October 2010, that a special video documentary was made about, which you will probably get to, about these genocidalists threatening the Murray-Darling Basin, that it should be shut down in its food bowl for the world.
Yes, that particular video, it will be very helpful for people to, if they do get a chance to look at it. It was produced by members of our LaRouche Youth Movement here in Australia, and is a very good summary of what has been done so far in terms of shutting down the basin and the attacks on our farmers and our producers. And it gives an introduction to, in fact, exactly how this green ideology and the British Empire itself has orchestrated, step by step, the smashing of our food production in the, you know, in the basin.
Well, we want to pursue that, but let me just broaden this just a moment and bring Canada in the picture. In this sense, Jean-Philippe, that I think this fabulous world-class project, where some Snowy River basin runoff was diverted so that the Murray-Darling system would be, that's one way to call it, more reliable, have more water more of the time. But likewise, there are, even though the scale might be different, Jean-Philippe, in Canada, a lot of the wheat that people eat around the world comes from one place, from Saskatchewan. That's not the exclusive wheat belt, but it's the center of it. And you gave a presentation at a NWAPA conference in Montreal, I think in December, that I want people to look at on larouchepac.com. It was posted just a week ago. But would you say something about the time period? I think the Murray-Darling was in the 50s and the Snowy Mountain Project and everything else. When was some of the Saskatchewan River, when were those improvements made? And because it's part of the positive side of what we can do in the world.
Well, the first thing I would say, just to maybe add to the emergency, the situation, is that if you just look at the wheat production, we've lost in a year, we've lost 47 million tons of wheat. And Canada, who is the sixth biggest producer in the world, is producing 25 million tons. So in a year, imagine that the whole production of wheat in Canada is completely wiped out. So this is major. We're talking about a major collapse of our production capabilities due to, the economic crisis. We've seen nations that are a major exporter of food refrain from exporting because the price is unstable, and they don't know if they'll be able to afford food later in the coming years. They might as well they keep their food stuff, if they keep bigger reserves. And the other problem is this problem that we're facing with the British Empire, which is a very immature idea of mankind's role in the universe. And that's why I gave this presentation mid-December on the development of the Canadian prairies, who are known worldwide as a major center of food production, especially wheat. 60% of Canada's wheat is produced in Saskatchewan, which is a relatively small area. But unlike today, at the time, people knew. They knew because they were faced with extinction. They knew that they had to intervene. they knew that nature was nasty, and a good soil in Saskatchewan, for example, a good soil during a certain year would be very good, and the next year would be awful. Why? Well, because of many different interventions from nature, whether it was a drought, whether it was locusts, whether it was too much, sometimes even too much rain would spoil the crop. So if you were living in the prairies, which is Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, in the 1930s, you'd probably be very, very thin, have an enormous amount of cavities. You'd be stinky too, because you couldn't wash yourself. And you actually face a very horrible living conditions. But the problem is that people would expect, you know, when you have a good year, if your soil is very profitable one year, sometimes the next year you would have a drought, so you wouldn't raise anything. But then you would hope for the next year to be better. And that's what kept a lot of people there, but they were not in control of the quality of their soil because of droughts, which are, by the way, which are cyclical things. It's not just happening like that. There's a way we can know these things. And in the 30s, the Canadian government at a certain point had to do something because they were losing all the production, which was a major, wheat was a major, it would bring a lot of revenues for the government through export of wheat. But at a certain point, it was just too much. You had everything during what they call the dirty 30s, where you'd have locusts, you'd have hail, you'd have just awful, awful weather. And also you'd have, which was awful too, probably worse, we had soil erosion. And still today, in those areas, and also in Australia, you're going to have these huge clouds of soil. You basically see your top quality soil leaving its place and mm-hmm. being pushed through the wind.
The dust clouds, uh-huh.
Yeah, the dust clouds. So, and you're losing your soil. So the government had to intervene to keep that soil in place, which meant a massive mobilization of the best minds of the area, scientists, agronomists, which was still a new thing at the time. And these people managed to keep the soil there by developing new kinds of grass. Actually, in the what's called the Palliser Triangle in Canada, which is pretty much the southern part of the prairies, you had a new grass that was planted. It was actually a foreign grass. It was a grass from Russia, and they planted, which was actually better than the grass they had before. So the indigenous grass was not as strong as the crested wheat grass, who was growing in Siberia and had a very, it was just a tough grass. You know, whether it was cold or hot, it would stick there. And it didn't need too much attention, didn't need too much water. So they managed to keep the soil stable. And then, obviously, the second question, I mean, you had questions like how to deal with the locusts, how to develop certain kind of pesticides. And that, by the way, was also a huge mobilization because they didn't have jets, you know, or planes just dropping pesticides all over the place. They had to put it themselves, so you'd need tens of thousands of people to go throughout the country and to put the pesticides at different places. But the third part of that mobilization was water. And in a sense, it's still, I mean, to Canada, it's still pretty new. It started that really, like, seriously in the 50s. Before that, they had certain projects of building dugouts or very small dams, you know, with mud and debris. So they were trying pretty much to conserve water from precipitation. But at a certain point, you needed dams. You needed to really organize your whole province or your whole area. And it sort of worked. The problem is that the dams that were made in Canada in the 50s, you had the in that area per se, you had on the St. Mary River and the South Saskatchewan River, projects that were whether to bring water to an area or to drain an area. Both things were done, especially in Saskatchewan. You had to drain certain parts and you had to irrigate other parts. And still today, Saskatchewan is not using fully its irrigation potential because the government doesn't want to invest anymore. Despite drought that is still present, it doesn't invest. So they're cutting the cost on that. But today I think the main difference is that with NWAPA, you're not looking at a regional, local reorganization of your water system, but you're looking at the whole continent itself. Because and if you're able to bring much more water, for the prairies, we're talking about 22 million acre feet of water, which would help, according to the NWAPA report, it would have increased the amount of soil for agriculture would increase by about 50%. So then you'd be able to feed, millions more people. Your potential would be much, much bigger. And I think this is exactly why, that's why the British imperialists, they're talking about, as Nolan was saying, how crazy do you have to be to talk about depopulating Australia, right? I don't think they're too crowded over there, but I think that what they're afraid of is the potential that, if Australia is a food exporter, and they're just that, there's probably, let's say, tens of thousands of farmers. It's not everybody's a farmer, but those farmers are feeding people throughout the world. Same thing with Canada. Canada produced 25 million tons of wheat, but exports 20 of it to Russia, China, India, and other places. So the potential is enormous. We could be feeding like a lot of people for the future. And then that's why you have the British coming in, not intervening to stop floods or to prevent damage from floods, not intervening to protect people from potential droughts, like we see still today in the prairies. And just to give an example, in Canada, recently there was a law that was discussed. I don't know if it was passed yet, but in April, end of April, in British Columbia, they brought it's called the Clean Energy Bill, or the Clean Energy Act. And it basically calls for a ban on large-scale dam construction in BC, which is the main area for NWAPA, where the water is going to go through the Rocky Mountain Trench. So all this area would be, you wouldn't be able to build dams, which is insane. So that's how the British are trying to do this. But obviously, when we organize people in the street, and you tell them about what we can do, and I think this is the only way we can really organize people against these sort of crazy genocidal policies, is to look at what is exactly the potential, and what is it that we can do better, what is it that we can do more in order to really get rid of this poverty and to start developing these other countries. And the food is obviously the major, the key to develop people. We need more food. Lots of it.
Well, Nolene, that must be very familiar. Your family goes back into farming too, and everything he says about the Canadian prairies in Saskatchewan has direct experience in your side too, right?
Mm-hmm. The thing is, what Jean-Philippe is saying about the potential, there's no question when we look, for example, at the Murray-Darling Basin, and I'll speak to it because it's our biggest food bowl. It's not our only one, but the technology and the extraordinary development that's occurred over, you know, more than a century in developing that basin. We have some of the most advanced technologies and practices, you know, adopted by farmers, family farmers, the entrepreneurs, you know, that go out and make it their business to solve the problems and to innovate and to improve. And there are many examples, wonderful, extraordinary examples of that. And it's precisely that quality of human creativity and inventiveness that is really under assault. And you see it in the construction of, for example, you know, our great Snowy Mountain scheme, which was the one great national infrastructure project that Australia did in fact build. We had, in the post-war period, we had dozens and dozens of similar great projects that were all engineered and should have been built and could have been built, but from the period of the late 60s, early 70s on, when the green environmentalist movement really was launched in earnest internationally, it was like it went from night to, from day to night in an instant, and virtually everything has been oriented since then to, if not a reversal of those, you know, great the progress that was made. Certainly, you know, the attempt has been to cease any further development, but now we've reached a point, particularly with our Murray-Darling Basin, the attempt, and it's hard to imagine. I mean, we've got our irrigators in the basin have been told by the government, and in fact, there's an Act of Parliament was passed in 2007 called the Water Act, which mandates now that almost 40% of the water that irrigators have been using and are entitled to use for growing crops is now going to be either bought back or they're simply not being allowed to use that water. In the case of, for example, right now, it's highly controversial because in South Australia, where all of this volume of floodwater is pouring down the Murray River, and you've got irrigators there that are only being allowed to use a maximum of 67% of the water that they're entitled to and in most cases have paid for. But because of free trade arrangements, commodity trading in water and other deals that have been done between the states and different organisations under the free market, those irrigators are watching water just flush out to sea, and here they are trying to recover from a decade-long drought prior to these floods, and they can't even use that water. So, you know, there's a degree of insanity that that characterises this shutdown. And even now, thank goodness, many Australians are seeing this with new eyes. And that's what we're finding in our organising as a political movement here in Australia, is that much of the ferment that we're seeing explode now in other countries such as Egypt and Tunisia and the upheaval that's coming from the masses of the population is boiling away here as well. And the problem that we've got is that people know, the farmers certainly know, many of the communities in these regional and more remote areas, but even in the cities, they know that their government has no intention of protecting that capability, or they're destined for genocide. So with that kind of realization starting to come, we really have the beginning of a mass strike process underway in Australia, which the CEC, the Citizens Electoral Council, is intersecting in a very interesting way. And after more than 20 years of fighting on this continent for LaRouche's ideas of political economy and restoring the physical infrastructure, through an American system of credit creation, etc., we're now at a point where many, many people are listening. So it's we've got enormous opportunities, but as my husband Craig said, Craig Isherwood, we're not going to win that victory, that war against the green movement, the environmentalist movement, which is the British Empire, it's nothing else but that, without liberating ourselves from this old British imperial system. And that's a real challenge for a nation that's always been part of the empire of the Commonwealth. And to some degree, we had a visit here down in Australia just last week from Her Majesty's Foreign Minister, William Hague, and he spelled it out in very clear terms that Britain was now looking to revitalise its relationship with the Dominions and with the rest of the Commonwealth, the 54 members of the Commonwealth, which is really the old empire, and that it was his number one priority to revitalise and rebuild and extend that empire. So, you know, the British are really looking to take a much more aggressive and active role in capturing parts of the Commonwealth for the next stage of their fight for survival. So when we look at what's happening, for example, in the Murray-Darling Basin and elsewhere around the country, to shut down our farmers, to destroy our agricultural capabilities and our ability to provide food for much of the rest of the world, this is part of the agenda to radically reduce the human population back to, as Mr. LaRouche, has repeatedly said, 2 billion people, perhaps, if not less.
Right.
And so it's an enormous battle, but one which is now opening up in a way that we've never seen before. And the good thing is our organisation here in Australia is in good fighting shape, and beginning 3rd of January this year, straight up in the new year, we launched a massive campaign where we've brought many of our best activists from all over the nation into our headquarters in Melbourne. And we have a functioning war room there where we're pouring out hundreds of phone calls a day to all of the key people in the Murray-Darling Basin, but even further afield than that. But we're contacting councillors, we're contacting farmers, all of the industry groups and organisations represented across that entire region, and mobilising them to join this war of liberation against the old empire. And the response has been really quite extraordinary. So it's...
Jean-Philippe, you may want to say something about the degree of mobilization, where I understand you, Montreal's a world center also for students and engineering firms, mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that it's important to realize that, as Nolene described, the empire is actually scared of what can happen to it over the coming weeks. And that's probably why they're trying to gather their forces to impose their system on a population which is trying to move away from that system, which is imperialism, free trade. So they're trying to gather their forces, but the only way they can go is really towards fascism. They can only try to impose their crazy system of looting, bringing people back to colonialism as soon as they can. So, and as LaRouche was saying, LaRouche says, well, whether you pick that system and you collapse with the empire, because their system is unviable, or you go towards a Nawapa-style economic recovery. And that's the message I think we have to tell everybody. As LaRouche mentioned in his webcast, one point that really struck me, and he said many times, he said, this is no time for debate. If people want to debate, they can go, in a cafe and debate with their friends and wait for death to pick them up. But people who are serious should not be debating. They should be discussing. But you can't debate neither the crisis, that the crisis is there, and you can't debate the LaRouche's solution. It's LaRouche's solution or nothing. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that people are ready to hear that. We've seen that in Ireland, for example, people revolting against the crisis over there. But we see it, I think we see it wherever we are. We see it here in Montreal with a response. See, here we've been seeing two things. We've been seeing a population which is eager to discuss the Nawapa project and realizing its importance for the world. Well, what it could do for North America. And at the same time, you have people coming out from engineering sectors and or universities saying, like this very old saying, I don't want to ship my water down to the United States because that's my water and I love my water. But anyway, it's water that runs off every year in the ocean. It's not like people really care about that. But these sort of weak arguments coming out, which is basically just a slander against Nawapa, these things won't last as long as we stay sharp on the principles. So what we've been trying to do right now is to go on campus to impose the Nawapa program, to get people to discuss about it, make presentations on campuses, show people certain of the most important videos for Canada on the Nawapa project. And hopefully to get now we have, like, we're going to start calling, like, really every living engineers in Canada, every firm, whether they're from, Newfoundland or BC, because Nawapa is going to be a national project, so everybody is going to be into it wherever they are, and get this thing reworking before things get just worse, and we know that a revolution can go bad as well. We can miss the real shift. We can have a very ugly revolution, or we're going to have something that's going to bring people back to their senses and get this development going throughout the world.
I think that's one of the things that we've seen very clearly is that we've got a population that's now waking, coming out of their slumber in many respects. But without us, without Lynn and his, what he represents as just the clarity of reason, of a science, a physical economic science principle, that's expressed in Nawapa, and obviously Australia's not connected by any land. We can't. We're a bit isolated down here, but nonetheless, the same concept applies, and we've got all of the potential here to be a critical part of the NAWAPA perspective for humanity. And but without the you know, the education process, without giving people the tools to understand history, you know, to understand what a real economy is, and you know, to have the inspiration of the courage to stand up against the kind of oppression that you know, any member of the British Commonwealth has always, you know, suffered. Without that quality of leadership, it's going to be very well. It's virtually impossible without that quality of you know, leadership from the front. And you're really seeing that now reflected in what's happening in Ireland. We here in Australia, we've got many Irish immigrants with Irish background, and people are watching the situation there very, very closely. And I know amongst our supporters are greatly inspired by what they, the fight, and the fact that the fight, you know, is very much inspired by Lynn is key. So you know, I think that we're in good shape to win this battle, but only if we're ruthless. And it is a war, as we've stated, a war of liberation from the empire. For us, that's very explicit because we've never not been part of the empire. But even for our friends in the United States, who have the greatest republic on earth, if they can keep it, you know, that is freeing ourselves from that now is all that matters.
Yes, I think one thing people hear, I just want to say, they people know the phone number, but and you can go online, but you usually, many people who listen have a liaison in parts all around the United States. And this state drive we're having in state capitals, I want to enlist everyone. You can call 800-278-3135 for EIR online and for LaRouche Publications, 800-278-3135. And I recommend people contribute, buy dozens of EIR online for state legislators, and you're contributing to this, obviously, this international effort. And one thing, Nolene, when people go on LaRouchePub.com and look under international, look under Australia and Canada, the degree of royal genocidalist intervention, sometimes it, even though you've had it in different forms in the United States, you even have a population minister, is that right? It's reached the degree where you're supposed to have a government say you have too many people, is that true?
Yes, our former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd appointed a population minister. And when he was overthrown under our wonderful British parliamentary system and replaced with our current Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, she immediately altered the name and redubbed him the Minister for Sustainable Population.
Oh, no.
So any illusion that there would be a minister or a faction of the government that would be paying attention to the necessity to increase Australia's population became very evident straight away that their intention is depopulation. It is the green agenda that's been dictated by Prince Philip and the old empire right from the very earliest days. So
I think we'll have to tell Prince William and his new wife not to procreate so that we can
make a contribution. well, the royal wedding is going to be a royal distraction. I'm sure they're hoping that people will get caught up in the the ridiculous romanticism of this whole thing, and many Australians will, unfortunately, because that's the way we've been brainwashed and indoctrinated over centuries. But there are a great many people also who are ready for a republic in Australia. And there's increasing discussion about that, although, again, without our intervention, it's a very shallow discussion. There's no real historical depth of understanding of what a republic is, a true republic. And so that's part of our role as well, is obviously educating people on that. But
well, that's
very
the
difficult to convince people they need a republic if they are still in a state of denial about the role of the British Empire, which is still the case in most parts of Australia.
Well, that's a note you've put it to people, and that's the note we've run out of time. We're going to end with that we are making ready for a republic in Australia, Canada, and resuming in the United States. So I thank all of you, Jean-Philippe Leblou, Nolene Isherwood. And this will be the closeout of the LaRue Show, January 29th, 2011. Listen again, February 5th. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.